From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in West Menlo Park.
Haight-Ashbury.
I live in the Western Addition.
Bernal Heights.
San Bruno.
I live in Pacific Heights.
Coming up, we look into whether or not San Francisco's Chinatown is on the brink of change.
Your fourth generation young Chinese American woman would rather go to Napa for her wedding.
Then senior citizens who are keeping Chinatown's spirit alive by kicking up their heels.
Nowadays, when we come out in our fishnet stockings, we don't even have to get to the stage yet. People are like, whoa, they start applauding.
And we'll hear about an author who knew how to listen.
In my mind, he's the greatest listener writer we have ever had.
That's all coming up today on Cross Currents. In a recent article for the April issue of San Francisco Magazine, journalist Andrew Leonard looks at the fate of Chinatown and whether it's on the brink of serious social and cultural change. The article, called Long Live the Empress, focuses on the closing and sale of an iconic Chinese restaurant and banquet hall called the Empress of China. Once so popular that it was booked more than 2 years in advance, it's now being advertised as an ideal space for creative technology tenants. Andrew Leonard sat down with Leah Rose from the podcast The Upshot to talk about what the restaurant's fate may represent for the rest of Chinatown.
What is the Empress of China and what is so significant about its closing?
The Empress of China is a six-story building in the heart of Chinatown, overlooking Grant Avenue and Portsmouth Square. It's not the oldest building. It was built in the 60s, but it has a lot of symbolic cultural importance. It was built by one of the leading families of Chinatown. And from the very beginning, the top two floors were dedicated to what was planned to be the marquee premier restaurant in Chinatown. That's the Empress of China.
And then what happened in the 80s? Why did it all of a sudden become, or what changed about, did something change about the space? Did something change about the neighborhood of Chinatown?
Part of it's that people just don't go to big banquets as much as they used to. Third, fourth generation. I talked to one woman who has written a bunch of cookbooks and lived in Chinatown, and I guess her quote was, "Your fourth generation young Chinese American woman would rather go to Napa for her wedding than a 50-year-old building in Chinatown."
Right, yeah. It's a little antiquated.
There were also issues with the family that owned the building and was involved with the restaurant not reinvesting. So the place was just falling apart.
You made a point. You drew really special attention to the way that the real estate ad for the Empress of China building, the way the ad was written. What was so significant to you about the way that it was being marketed?
It wasn't so much the way it was written, which was one part. It was the picture, the mock-up that they used to describe what this should look like, which made it look like the inside of Google or Twitter or Facebook. And if you've ever had been to the Empress of China or just walked down Grant Avenue, you'd kind of have a visceral response to that picture. This does not look like Chinatown. This is complete takeover by tech. And in San Francisco right now, that's a pretty hot button issue. The Mission has a new condominium every day displacing some art space or, Latino market. And people are pretty anxious about it. And Chinatown's got such a long history and distinct culture that I was originally assigned to this story to figure out, was the sale of this building the first step in tech-driven gentrification? Was what's happening to the rest of San Francisco about to happen to Chinatown?
Yeah, I was curious if you saw the sale of this building as yet another indication that San Francisco may be becoming a monoculture.
Well, that was what I was charged to investigate. After spending months talking to people and wandering around, I came away thinking that that's not really that likely to happen. Chinatown has some built-in characteristics that make it, for better or worse, much more resistant to change than other parts of the city.
Why is that? I thought that was really interesting. You said there's a built-in resistance to gentrification, partly because of the immigrant culture. What are some other reasons why that is?
There's two or three factors. One is kind of a unique concentration of ownership of the housing stock. Nonprofits like the CCDC, the Chinese Community Development Corporation, and the family associations own about 40% of the housing in Chinatown. And the family associations are kind of permanent institutions. They don't, you know, there's no pressure to sell ever and make a quick profit. They're there to support their own slice of the community. So they just keep renting to the retail outlets in the bottom floor and have these really cheap rental places in the top. And there's not that same kind of let's get rich quick. In the Mission, most of the housing stock is owned by big corporations that own tons of housing. So they're looking to make a profit whenever they can. The immigration part is interesting too, because Chinatown continues to be the first stop for new Chinese immigrants. And as a result, it's one of the kind of poorest parts of the city, but it also kind of continually refreshes the family associations with new members, and it creates this imperative, you know, to, you know, feed and house these people. You need cheap housing and cheap food. So that kind of everywhere else you have this the newcomers coming in tend to be considerably more affluent. And Chinatown has a steady influx of poor and a lot of in-house elderly for the last few generations, which makes it a lot different.
If you're just joining us, I'm Leah Rose, and today I'm talking to Andrew Leonard, who wrote Long Live the Empress for the April issue of San Francisco Magazine. Did you see in reporting this story, did it seem like there's any threat to those resources that are there that are providing for people who are newly immigrating to San Francisco?
There's always threat, but Chinatown is pretty politically connected. You know, the mayor's Chinese, Board of Supervisors has usually two or three Chinese members. Rose Pak is considered the power behind the throne in San Francisco politics. So the city has a lot of the neighborhood has a lot of power to kind of restrict who does what.
You write that Chinatown needs an infusion of fresh blood, fresh investment, fresh ideas. Do those ideas need to come within the Chinese community to be viable, or could they also come from tech companies?
I think they absolutely have to have some connection to local community. I think that's the lesson of the Empress of China, is that when the backstory that didn't really get into the articles is the family that owns the building is, you know, now in its third generation. There's maybe 60 cousins. There may have been some economic pressure, like let's get out and split up this money. And they pushed forward without a real plan in advance and without really consulting the power brokers in the community. They chose a real estate agent that had no ties to the community, which riled some people. And so far, they haven't been able to sell the building. I think in Chinatown, you need to work with the power structure that's there. And it's, I think, important not just to Chinatown but to the city as a whole that what makes Chinatown special is its history from the beginning of San Francisco. And you don't want to lose that in any kind of pell-mell gentrification.
That was journalist Andrew Leonard talking about his article, Long Live the Empress. That conversation is from the podcast The Upshot with Leah Rose, engineered by Justin Richmond. You can find a link to Leonard's article and subscribe to The Upshot at our website, kalw.org. Click on Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Julie Kane, in today for Hanat Baba. The Empress of China is a symbol of Chinatown's rich cultural past. Take a walk around there any day of the week, and you can find other such examples. Traditional music, dim sum, silk dresses, tap dancing. That's right, tap dancing. From the 1940s till the 1960s, San Francisco's Chinatown was home to a thriving Chinese-American nightclub scene. The clubs had names like Forbidden City, the Chinese Sky Room, and the Shanghai Lo. They had showgirls, comedians, jazz singers, and magic. And these clubs had wide appeal. Celebrities like Bing Crosby, Duke Ellington, and Lauren Bacall were all spotted over the years, along with tourists, businessmen, and locals. The Forbidden City even inspired a musical, Rodgers and Hammerstein's Flower Drum Song, which was also made into a movie.
Grant Avenue, San Francisco, California, USA. Looks down from Chinatown over a foggy bay. You travel there in a trolley.
The scene died out in the 60s as Carol Doda-style topless dancing eclipsed the old variety show style. But there's a group keeping the memory of those old Chinatown nightclubs alive. In this piece from our archives, KALW's Jen Chin brings us the story.
Starting from the top.
Wednesdays are rehearsal days for the Grant Avenue Follies, a 12-member dance troupe that does tap, jazz, hula, and other styles. They perform 4 to 6 times a month. That may not sound like a lot unless you know that most of the dancers here are over 70.
No. What time are we performing?
At 11 o'clock. Uh-huh. Yeah, in the new facility, fifth floor, Asian section.
The group came together 9 years ago. Cynthia Yi, who used to dance at the Chinese Sky Room, was at a senior center dance class. Yi is an active member of the Chinese American community, and at the time, she was helping to plan a fundraiser for Chinese Hospital in Chinatown.
And so I said, come on, let's do a night in at the Forbidden City nightclub.
How high the ocean!
All of them had great memories of performing in the clubs, the glittering stage lights, the sassy costumes, meeting all kinds of new people every night. So, the four former showgirls, then in their 50s and 60s, put together a number for the event.
We were an instant hit. And it was so much fun. We said, oh, let's do another one. And that's how it all began.
The troupe now performs at senior centers, nursing homes, VA hospitals, and fundraisers all over the world. And they've expanded from the original four former professionals to include people from all walks of life, a retired pharmacist, a school teacher, a dentist.
Every time we would do a fundraiser or get together, people would come up to us, oh my gosh, do you know I've always wanted to be a dancer, but my mother and father would never allow me to take dancing lessons. And I said, well, come on, let's get to the senior center. You're retired now, and let's start dancing.
Yi grew up in Chinatown in the 50s.
I grew up on Beckett Street. It's an alleyway right off of Jackson. And then I was about 10 years old, we moved up the hill to Powell and Clay. And then my mom still lives on Powell and Clay, except in a different building.
Her upstairs neighbors were dancers and entertainers who worked at the nightclubs. And one night, her parents took her to the biggest and most popular of the Chinese clubs, Charlie Lo's Forbidden City.
That's when I first saw, you know, Dorothy Toy, Toy and Wing dance, and that's when I fell in love.
Dorothy Toy and Paul Wing were known as the Chinese Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, and Dorothy Toy just happened to be one of Cynthia Yee's neighbors. When she was 7, Toy encouraged her to go to ballet classes. And when she turned 17, Toy asked her to join the show at the Sky Room.
See that up there? That's the Chinese Sky Room. Where the stained glass is, that's the Chinese Sky Room. And inside had beautiful, wonderful antique chandeliers. And that's where I danced.
Where the Sky Room used to be is now a conference room for the Grant Plaza Hotel. The former site of Forbidden City now houses a franchise of the Barbizon Modeling School. And though she still spends a lot of time in Chinatown, Yi lives in the Richmond now. There's a large Chinese population there. And every Wednesday, there are the Grant Avenue Follies, rehearsing at the Rec Center on 18th Avenue. Ivy Tam is one of the group's original members. She performed at the Forbidden City in the early 60s, but before the Follies, she hadn't danced for many years. She says she's happy to have returned to dancing now at age 78, and especially happy to be able to bring back good memories for other seniors who aren't as spry.
At least when we perform, make them a little happier. That's one thing I can do. You know, if not, what I can do for them? Nothing. I think our little entertainment, make them happy for that day. That will be way good feeling for me.
Tam says she also enjoys seeing the surprise on people's faces when they realize what kind of show they're in for.
I can tell if they don't know us, they never see before, they expect we doing just the Chinese dancing, right? And little fan, little, you know, and things like that. They don't think we will do tap, we will do hula, we will do anything.
Tam's specialty is a dance with giant feather fans that always wows the audience. And that's not all.
And those days when people look at it, really is kind of, you know.
Pretty sexy.
Sexy, uh-huh. But they like it, though.
They love it. They love our fishnet stockings. I mean, definitely. Nowadays, you know, when we come out in our fishnet stockings, we don't even have to get to the stage yet. People are like, whoa, they start applauding.
Both dancers agree on the best part about being with the Grand Avenue Follies.
But what makes us different really is the sisterhood that we keep.
The ladies socialize, travel, and eat huge Chinese restaurant meals together. They drive each other to appointments and watch out for each other's health. They say it's good to have that sense of family with the group, especially now that they can't find it in Chinatown. With waves of successive immigration from very different areas of China, and younger generations moving out of the neighborhood and even out of the city, the place just doesn't feel the same anymore.
People before is like big family. My mother was very sick. She had cancer. I take her to treatment every day or something. And those grocery store, they will ask, how's your mother? And then when if she's sitting in the car, and then they will go out to say hello to her.
Every apartment, we knew each other in the lobby. I don't think you have that nowadays. You know, it's not as close. My mother still lives in Chinatown, and she's very fortunate that her building is, you know, very close-knit. But in general, I don't believe that, you know, you see that anymore.
Yi hopes that the Grand Avenue Follies can bring some of the feeling of that old Chinatown back, at least for those that remember it. But she's also thinking ahead.
It's my dream to have a small venue, small place in Chinatown, to have the best wonton mein, wonton noodles, and the downstairs cellar to be a live entertainment area, and to have people to be able to come back to Chinatown, second generation, third generation, fourth generation, where they feel comfortable and say, wow, my grandfather used to live here, and they want to see the place. They want to experience the old Chinatown flavor.
For now, the ladies of the Grant Avenue Follies are bringing that flavor back, one song and dance at a time. In San Francisco, I'm Jen Chien for Cross Currents. The Grant Avenue Follies will perform on May 31st at the Far East Cafe in Chinatown. For more information, go to our website, kalw.org, click on Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Julie Kane. And now it's time for the book report, brought to you by the Litography Project.
Ah, the Litography Project!
Shh. Your guide to the literary Bay Area.
For the book report, we ask Bay Area authors to tell us about a book that's meaningful for them. Today, we hear from Peter Orner.
My book report is on Joe Gould's Secret by Joseph Mitchell. Joseph Mitchell was a journalist and writer who wrote for The New Yorker in what people might consider the heyday, the 50s and 60s. He did a profile of a homeless man, Joe Gould, who would wander around the East Village reciting poetry and panhandling and being basically just a fixture in the East Village. Joe Gould was purportedly writing the longest book ever written, a book 11 times longer than the Bible, called The Oral History of Our Time. He would walk around Greenwich Village with those school notebooks, you know, with the marble covers, and he would fill them up, and he would take notes on everything everyone was saying. So Mitchell would sit for hours listening to Gould just tell him his life story over and over again. To my mind, he's the greatest listener writer we have ever had. So this is Joe Gould telling his life story in a diner to Joseph Mitchell. The trouble is, the more radical these people became, the more know-it-all they became, and the more self-important and the more self-satisfied. And they sat around in the same old village hangouts that they had sat around in when they were just ordinary bohemians, and they just talked as much as they ever had, only now it wasn't art or sex or booze that they talked about, but the coming revolution and dialectical materialism and the dictatorship of the proletariat and what Lenin meant when he said this and what Trotsky meant when he said that. And they acted as if any conclusions they arrived at on these matters might have far-reaching effect on the future of the whole world. In other words, they completely lost their sense of humor. What Mitchell did was show us in our very best light, and he profiled people in their most miraculous light. I think this book will challenge anybody to see any individual, whoever they are, whether they live on the streets or not, in a much deeper way.
Peter Orner is the author of four books, including Last Car Over the Sagamore Bridge and Love and Shame and Love. He's also the editor of two collections of oral histories published by Voices of Witness. Do you have favorite Bay Area authors? Sure you do. Give us a call and tell us about them. We're at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. To keep up with the latest from KALW, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or you can subscribe to the Cross Currents podcast on iTunes. We are listener-supported public radio, which means we are here because of you. And for that, we thank you. Our team includes Audrey Dilling, Chris Hambrick, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Ted Muldoon, Colin Peden, Liz Mack, Marlo McKenzie, Casey Miner, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. The line producer was Judy Silber. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Our managing producer is me, Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll be talking about unconventional ways to search for precious water.
Is the water 200 feet? Is the water 300 feet?
The search for water.
390.
That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents from KALW News. This music is by Peninsula band The Corner Laughers. You can see them performing songs from their new album at the downtown branch of the Redwood City Library on Wednesday, starting at 7 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Julie Kane.
Ancient places where we walk together from Jerusalem.